Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Julian Parry on corruption in sleepy Somerset. Also, Kirsty McKinder is on the line. She's also trained as an intelligence officer in the British Army, but she's not really happy about the way they use that training. Also, our tech roundup this week, looking at passwords and alternatives with Elia Pablo. But we start this week with Elia and passwords in our tech roundup. Hi, Elia, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Every time there seems to be a breach in internet security, people are urged to change their passwords. At least I am. I mean, I know I am. Or to make them stronger. But does the difficulty of a password really matter when the security is compromised? I mean, we keep hearing about the NSA looking at our internet traffic. What's the point of having a password when they can read it?
Yeah, that's the thing. Obviously, it's more safety to have a password which is like a mix of characters, capital letters, number, and just brackets and all sort of characters, not just letters and numbers, than ABCD1234, which is one of the most common passwords, sadly. But the thing is, like, hackers can actually peek into the space where the password is stored in plain. That means in plain text. That means that they actually can see all the characters of your password, and then they can link it with your username, and they can just get in information about you, or even, like, they can link it with your credit card number. So at the end, it doesn't really matter how difficult it is, your password. Obviously, as like the most difficult, the best. But if they want to hack it, it doesn't really matter how complicated it is.
Well, last week we were talking about biometrics, which is an alternative to having a password. Maybe seems to be one of the popular alternatives to having a password. What is biometrics?
Basically, it's about the physics of the people. So physical characteristics that are unique, because each one of us have like an appearance, a face, an eye, a fingerprint. It can also be the heartbeat of your heart. So it can be actually anything. Even I've read even the way you move. But obviously these things will require some kind of devices.
Now, you said the eye there. I mean, are you talking about actually scanning the iris and some kind of unique, almost like a fingerprint that comes right from the individual's eye?
Exactly. That's one of the ideas, yeah. The most popular, though, are the fingerprint or the face.
Now, I've seen some of this facial recognition software, which can be quite amusing sometimes, because if you've got a beard, sometimes it recognises it as the wrong person with the head upside down.
Yeah, that actually is one of my worries about the face thing, or even like with glasses or without glasses, or changing your colour of the hair.
So how does that sort of software work? I mean, is it possible maybe to get the wrong person? Because it must be millions of people. You're trawling through a database, you've got a picture of somebody, and it says it's this person, but you know, the chances are it might not be.
That's one of the reasons why it's not very spread as a method, the face one at least, because basically you can imagine a twin. You can actually get into your twin computer by this method, or even someone that is very similar. So that's the problem. I don't really know how they interpret the face, but it doesn't sound to me very secure.
Okay, what about the voice? Well, you can hear your voice and my voice, but I know some of the earlier Apple computers, that was one of the trendy ways they sold it. So they said, oh, well, you don't have to type a password in. You just say hello or whatever it is in your own voice, and the computer will recognize it and let you in, recognize that as you.
It should be quite secure, I would say, but it has the same problem with the face. You can take a picture, or you can take you can record someone's voice, and then you just get in easily.
That's right, of course. It's very easy to do that. It's actually, yes, you're right, worrying, isn't it? All you need to do is put a fake face, a fake voice. The other thing with the voice recognition software is, if you've got enough of somebody speaking, what you can do is you can then start to synthesize their voice.
Yes.
And you can say, you could come onto the telephone almost pretending and speaking with the same voice, and someone might think they recognize them, give them information, tell them what they're doing, and almost as that person.
Yes, exactly. That's why one of the things why these biometrics system is right now not that spread is because people don't really trust it.
No, and I don't blame them. Okay, so what about other alternatives?
Well, there is, for example, this multi-factor authentication, which...
Pardon? What's that?
It's a multi-factor authentication. So basically, it's like it's a new method, but it's not very stated yet because it requires a lot of money to start, to be honest. But basically, it came with three different factors. So first of all, let's say you are in your friend's house, okay? And you want to access to your email. So you will go to Gmail, let's say, and you will put your password. So it's something that just the user should know. Your password, a PIN number, it doesn't really matter. Then it will say the second factor would be something that only the user has, which would be a device, like let's say they will send a message to your mobile phone and then you will have to add this code, or you would have like a smart card that you will introduce to the computer. It really can be anything. They are working on it. And then some of them includes a third factor. That's why it's called the multi-factor. That is something that only the user is, which is biometrics. Then here it comes your face, your fingerprint.
But you've just said things. The biometric thing is not necessarily secure. Because as soon as you've given your biometric data once across the internet, someone else could find that, like the NSA and GCHQ, and they can fake it.
The thing is, my personal opinion is there is nothing 100% secure right now, and I don't think they will ever be able to guarantee the security. But this multi-factor thing, it seems kind of safer because you actually have to go through three stages. So are they, obviously, if they want to do it, they will. But it just make it more complicated. Also, one problem with this is that there is already some malware in the mobile phones, which are actually infected the mobile phones. So let's say they're trying to get into your bank account, to put an example, and then the bank is going to send an email or a message to your mobile phone, but they are infecting the mobile phone, so they will receive your message and they will get being able to get in.
Oh, sounds like a complete nightmare the internet has become. I reckon
yes.
If certainly the things with banking, anything to do with something really important like that, just tell your bank, I want nothing to do with internet banking. I'm going to come into the bank if I need some money.
This is one of the advice, to be honest.
But the trouble is, they're closing branches. So you better get in there quick, folks. One thing I would say about that authentication, when you're in a remote location, well, I, for example, tried to use one of my Yahoo accounts on my mobile phone. I put a password in. It says, we'll send you a code to your phone. It sent a code to my phone. I entered that code into the Yahoo on my smartphone. And you know what it said? You are now locked out. You cannot use it for the next 3 days. And that was exactly the correct code that they'd sent me. So they can also play games with you, these big corporations, where you think you're going to get authenticated and you don't.
Or maybe they identified there was some kind of hazard on your phone that they thought you were on the owner.
Well, possibly. And also, always good idea when you're getting anything like this across the internet to check the URL at the very top to make sure you're actually on the website that you're supposed to be, like yahoo.com, and not some other spurious name, because they have websites that look exactly the same.
Yes.
It's just they've got a different URL. Anyway, with Google, they're trying to find a way to substitute passwords for another method. What do you know about that?
Well, it's called the Chromebook Easy Unlock, and it's quite
a
similar.
What?
Chromebook, like as Google Chrome, I would say.
Oh, Chrome.
Chromebook,
yeah.
Easy Unlock. So basically, it's similar to this multi-factor method that I was talking about. And it's the same. You basically get into a new device. You put your password, and then you will require the presence of a device that is registered by Android. So it's exactly the same. You will need your smartphone, or you will need like a smart card or some kind of device to connect it with the computer.
So you're not good enough as a person. You've got to have some electronic thing
exactly.
In your pocket that says, hey, this is really me.
And which worries me more is that it has to be registered by Android. So basically, not just they own like all the information you are looking for and everything you're doing on internet. They actually also want that everything that you do, all the services you require, you are going to do it through this device. So you will depend on Google for absolutely everything.
Well, it's a good way of monopolizing, yes. A bit like Microsoft have monopolized things through Windows.
Definitely,
it?
Yeah.
This is, sounds to me a bit like a Trojan horse. Another thing I'll say about Google Chrome is it started doing some funny things on my phone, so I just uninstalled it. I want nothing to do with it. What I was trying to do was just access the Twitter website via Google Chrome. And you know what it said to me? You cannot access this website. You must download the application. So I wasn't allowed by Google Chrome to look at the Twitter website. I had to download the application instead. So you know what I did? I uninstalled Google Chrome forever, and I found a much nicer browser. I think it's Opera that I use, but there's various other browsers you can use. You don't have to use Google, despite what they try and convince us. Anyway, Elliot, also it's a year on now since the Edward Snowden revelations of the whistleblower. Used to work for a private contractor. He got on a plane across to Hong Kong with a little pen drive in his pocket. And it's been a massive revolution, really, in what we know about what our own intelligence services are doing, basically targeting us without going through the courts. Now, there's a very good reason why the legal framework was set up, that if they want to put anybody under surveillance, a citizen under surveillance, they have to go to a court and get a court order and show a judge that they have a good reason to do it. Well, what Edward Snowden has shown us is that they are not doing that. They are going round the law. They're breaking the law. They are criminals hacking our information. They're not actually keeping with the law. So anyway, what are your thoughts a year on from the Edward Snowden revelations?
Well, I think the world awareness about this surveillance has changed a lot. People is more paranoid, which is actually good. And they are more aware of this privacy thing. Like, they are more aware of their own, say, like, their own personal information. And, like, they don't trust anymore Google or Facebook.
But what about everything we did before we knew? Because they've got all that information,
yeah,
even
definitely.
Though we didn't know they were going to have it.
There's nothing you can do about it, I guess. Like, that's why now there is this privacy advocates, like, claiming for protecting our own information. But I have the feeling that nothing has changed much. Like, people have changed. People is more aware. And people is fighting. And there is, like, this platforms like Reset the Net that we talked about it like a few weeks ago, and people is more conscious about it, but the governments are not doing anything.
Well,
about
I tell
it.
You what they are doing. They're going into the Guardian and ordering the Guardian editor to smash up the data that he's got, which is actually criminal evidence against the intelligence services. So the government, David Cameron himself, the Prime Minister, ordered them into the Guardian's offices to smash up evidence against the GCHQ, so which is very dangerous, I think. You know, if there's criminal evidence the Guardian have got, which might be used in a court to convict and send someone to jail, the Prime Minister shouldn't really be sending MI5 or whoever it is into the Guardian to smash that evidence to pieces. Very, very strange way for the government to react. The US has sort of come across more as the bad guy now. In the cyber world, because they're getting all this information and we are the target. But it's absolutely cast iron proved now that everybody on Earth is a target. Now, what does that really mean?
Well, basically, like, you know, this saying that everyone is innocent until you prove the opposite. It seems it's actually the other. It's like everyone is a criminal until you prove they are innocent. So, yes, like, the NSA said they can spy on everyone who is not American, which it seems kind of weird to me. But I think absolutely everyone is on their hands, and not just NSA, also UK intelligence services and European, German, everyone. Because it's like it seems like kind of a race of who gets more information and who spies on who.
Yeah, and don't worry about the Americans, because the British will collect all the information on the Americans, and if the NSA need any, they just hand it over.
Yes.
That's how they work, you know, because the British agencies are not supposed to spy on British people, so the American agencies spy on them, and if the British agencies want anything, the Americans will hand it over. Seems like cheating the system, and I'm not surprised that the former director of the GCHQ is on the record as saying he thinks that the people who are doing the oversight of these for us, which is the Intelligence and Security Committee, that the boss should be sacked. He's not the right man for the job. They've got to find someone who's actually up to the job. Anyway, Elia Pablo, thanks very much for joining us again on the Tech Roundup.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Julian Parry, our occasional corruption correspondent, I suppose we could call you, Julian. You keep an eye on things down in Somerset. And we've had a pretty shocking story over the last few weeks, which is this chap called Philip Judd. He was the deputy head of North Somerset Council. He's also the mayor of Weston, formerly. And he has been now pleaded guilty as a child pornographer. Philip Judd. It also turns out that he's a master mason. I'm not sure if he's been thrown out of the Freemasons by now, but certainly he was in St. Key Lodge, number 1, treble 2, in Weston-super-Mare, and then he was the Conservative mayor of Weston. It looks like he's rather disgraced now and is due to be sentenced next month. That's in July.
Well, hello, Tony. Yes, the situation with Philip Judd is intriguing, and since it's still, to some extent, sub judice, because he's not yet been sentenced, I suppose we have to show a lot of caution in what we say. At the same time, he does represent a body of people down there who are, I can say without fear of contradiction, utterly corrupt in other fields, which we have talked about before and we can touch on again.
Well, let's just put the record straight on what Judd has been accused of and pleaded guilty for. This is child pornography. This is from the Western Daily Press and the Bristol Post. Philip Judd, the ex-civic leader of Weston-super-Mare, pleaded guilty to 12 charges of making indecent photographs of a child and possessing prohibitive images. The 59-year-old appeared at Bristol Crown Court, which heard he possessed 151 films and 200 images of children. Judd lives in the Seaside Resort and was mayor between 2010 and 2011. He's also a former vice chairman of North Somerset Council. He's been released on bail to be sentenced in July. What it doesn't say, of course, in the newspapers is, and also I must admit I was a bit shocked that this hasn't gone national. This is an incredible scandal that somebody who's a Conservative mayor or whatever party mayor should have been convicted of such horrendous offences.
Well, there's always been a suspicion that certain people in the media, locally in Weston-super-Mare, were well entrenched with the whole system.
What was that?
Well, we do know that there have been problems with the media in Weston-super-Mare, with certain characters in the local press who seem to lean over backwards to cover up certain things that that were happening in council. I can give you a precise example of that. Back in 2008, when we had the report on the waste fraud, a reporter for the North Somerset Times did a very good piece, which absolutely slammed the council, as he should have done, and called it a whitewash. The same piece was then repeated in the Western Mercury under a different editor, and the headline was changed to say that the matter was all over and it was all okay. And when I challenged the original reporter on that point, he said, "This is an inappropriate headline." So there I have an absolute example of how even the local press are involved with the clique that have been running Weston-super-Mare and North Somerset for far too long.
And to what extent do you think Freemasonry plays a part in that? Because, of course, everybody knows Freemasonry is big in the police force, and it may be that the Freemasons can simply fail to press charges on one of their fellow Masons. You know, because what happens is they swear oaths of allegiance to each other, not to the public.
Absolutely. And one has to question whether or not that is appropriate. Now, firstly, I know that a huge number of the people who are in council down there in senior positions are indeed Freemasons, and some of them...
Would you like to name anybody?
I think we've got to go a bit careful there.
Why? If you actually know someone's a Freemason, surely...
Well, I know that Councillor Peter Bryant, for instance, is a Freemason for a start, and he's about number 3 in the council. So there is a record there of people. I was talking to him when I met him in the street not so long ago. We did mention the waste fraud, as I make sure I bring it up every time. And he said, "Oh, that happened years ago." So, you know, we have these people admitting they're taking public's money, they're spending the public's money, and they're admitting that there were problems that were then covered up. And, oh, well, never mind. They're there. We'll let that one go. And so we can do it again.
Well, essentially, the Freemason initiation ceremonies, particularly the third degree, which is where the expression giving someone the third degree comes from, are actually a threat of death. A knife is pointed against their bare chest. A rope is put around their neck. Now, this sounds to me really actually like that. What that's happening is they're saying, well, look, if you step out of line, we're going to kill you. It's that simple.
Well, I doubt they'd see it that way, but I do agree with you. I mean, that is the immediate impression.
The only piece of film I've ever seen was on a documentary of an initiation, was on a documentary made by HTV back, I think it was around about 1999, which you'll find online. It was called Rights and Wrongs, made by James Garrett, who was the then head of HTV News and Current Affairs. And it showed the candidate, as they were going through this initiation, actually physically shaking.
I can believe it. But, of course, all the Freemasons I've met, and I've met a few of them, I always realise upon analysis what silly people they are. It really is a very silly organisation. They're full of self-praise and self-emolument, you know, and you look at them and you say, what have you got to be so proud about? Well, but here's the big thing, your point about swearing secret oaths amongst each other. I think anybody who swears secret oaths in some secret society has no place in government, and I think there should be constitutional change to make sure that no person who has sworn one of these secret oaths is permitted to take part in public office.
When was the last time you swam across the Bristol Channel, Julian?
When did I swim across it? No, I've been halfway across in Martin Wool's very fine craft, the Westward Ho, but I've never tried to swim it.
Okay, well, anyway, if you were to land on the other side of there, actually into Wales, you'd find that actually any Freemason who's in public office has to declare their interest. They have to say it. And if they don't, then they are actually removed from office and can face criminal prosecution.
Well, of course, they have been a bit more strict on these things over in South Wales. I know that a lot of councillors in Swansea ended up behind closed doors, as did a bunch of councillors in Doncaster. But somehow Somerset, North Somerset, let me be very clear here, not to malign the wrong people, North Somerset seems to have a life of its own where these people, and I know one of them said this, actually said this to a constituent the other day, I can do as I like. That is their attitude. And we have seen them filch the public purse. The audit report on the waste said it was £300,000. Then you look at it, oh, that was over 2 years. I'll tell you now, it was £1 million a year for 10 years. Not a couple of hundred thousand quid for a couple of years. It was £1 million a year over 10 years.
Well, anyway,
and they blamed the wrong contractor.
Anyway, getting back to Philip Judd, the child pornographer. He was also Western Supermare's mayor between 2010 and 2011, as I said. He represented North Wirral on the Unitary Authority and was also a member of Western Town Council and also North Somerset South Area Planning Committee. Now, I know this is another place that Freemasons like to populate, Julian. Why is that, planning committees?
Well, let me tell you a little story. Some years ago, we had a very fine councillor, Labour man, called Glyn Duck. Now, I didn't agree with Glyn on a lot of things, but I will say this for the man. He was absolutely straight as a die. And there was a councillor who had been in charge of the North Area Planning Committee. The man died, and Glyn Duck took over his position. Glyn was horrified to find people knocking on his door, offering him bottles of whiskey, and wanting private meetings, which he, of course, refused and insisted officers were there, and he behaved absolutely impeccably. But the fact of the matter was, the practice of bribing certain officials was obviously well known and well practiced and well established.
Amazing. Also, going back to Mr. Judd, during his time as mayor, the ex-serviceman Mr. Judd was a former armourer in the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, and he was instrumental in affiliating the town of Weston-super-Mare with the Royal Marines 40 Commando. I think they're based in Taunton, down in Taunton, Julian. Yeah. He approached the unit based at Norton Manor Camp. Set up the partnership as a way of offering support to Marines and their families, some of whom are based in the town. Well, of course, this is also quite a nice tool for recruitment, because I know the army are having all sorts of trouble recruiting people, since most people think that if they're going to be joining the army now, they're going to go into a pointless, fruitless war.
Well, and they have a point. And I'll give Liam Fox a little bit of credit here. Until he put a stop to it, there was a time when the troops were being sent home on furlough from Afghanistan for a week, and half the week was spent flying home and the other half of the week was spent flying back again. And Liam Fox, for all the criticisms I have of him, at least he put a stop to that. But that's how criminally minded, crooked, sick minded is a better word perhaps, some of these people in authority and in the military have. I mean, so it's just sick minded.
Okay. Also, I know you've been digging into some of the things around Knightstone Island. Knightstone Island is that little bit that juts off in Weston-super-Mare. Yeah. What's been going on there? Because it's been developed, hasn't it? It was in a mess for years, and it looks as if it's been sold off and developed into luxury housing and a cafe and that sort of thing.
That's absolutely right. But in fact, when you look back into the history, that was a plan that has taken 20 years to come to fruition. Now, back in about 1977, the townsfolk spent £1.5 million on the swimming pool, and they needed it. And it was a perfectly good swimming pool, and it had its problems. There was the day the waves crashed in and pushed the windows in from on the seaward side, but it was all right because the polo team were in the pool and they were all in their causes and they got wet anyway, so it didn't really matter. I think it matters a lot more when you see that they turned that building into a block of flats. Now, we went before the planning committee when that planning application was going through originally, and we showed them the video taken by Martin Wolsey's father in 1964 showing huge waves crashing right over the top of the swimming pool. Okay, really major stuff. And we had tremendous difficulty getting that across, and there was one officer there, David Lawrence, one of the bad guys, a guy who has left the council now, but he actually said to the chairman that day, he said, "Don't let him speak." At which point my friend Bob Coleman, God rest him, we've just lost him, he stood up and said, "I'm a member of this committee. What do you want me to say, Julian?" And it was like a double act, you know. I thought Jimmy Durante was going to come through the door any minute. But the point was that at the end of the speech, I said, "In which case, you're going to kill somebody." And Bob just changed that to say, "I don't think it would be wise." But all of that, the whole Knightstone thing, is one massive fraud. Now, that fraud has been perpetrated over a long term. It's what we call long-term fraud, where small changes are made every so often, and nobody is supposed to notice, but some of us do. And what has happened here is that, having gone to Kingfisher Group, back in the late 80s, they couldn't make a pay, so it came back and it was leased off in 1992 to a guy called Chris Sanderson for $60,000 a year for 125 years. Chris Sanderson was in fact a bouncer at Spiral's nightclub in Yate, and we believe he was a front man for somebody else. So what happens is that a couple of years later, he's got a problem. I know it was a problem with Inland Revenue because I know who went to see the Inland Revenue about what he'd been doing. And suddenly he had to pass it on, and the lease then went to BS Knightstone Limited, which are part of the Bristol Stadium Group in Swindon. The fact of the matter is, when we looked into that, it was a £100 offshoot shelf company, and it was obviously not doing what they set out to do, because there were other people in the town recording everything that was being done in the newspaper, saying how all these people were going to come in and make a huge change to the place, they're going to bring millions, and it was all nonsense. Fast forward now to the 24th of June 2005, when they assign this lease, or it's supposed to have been assigned. The approval for assignment was given on the 13th of July 2004 in the Executive Committee. Councillor Tony Lake was behind it. He's still there. And that was the authority. He proposed it with Alan Hockridge, leader of the Liberal Democrats, and that was the authority that was given. In the end, we found, when we got to the papers, that on the 24th of June 2005, they leased it, not for 125 years, but they leased it for 250 years, not for $60,000 a year, plus the value of 92 planning consents and four businesses, but for £1 a year. Now, we reported that to the police. The police said, "Take it to Action Fraud." We've taken it to Action Fraud. Action Fraud have said, "This is corruption, and we're doing something about it." And guess what? Nothing's happening. And when I write to the chief constable and say, "What are you doing about it?" Suddenly, there's absolutely no reply. So my next letter will be to the Attorney General, who, I can tell the public, has got copies of all the papers and has acknowledged receipt.
This is interesting, because why don't the police actually start arresting fraudsters and banksters? This is the problem, because, I mean, the police are seeing themselves that they're having to, because of the corruption at the top in the banks, that they are having to lose their own people, are being sacked. And I'm surprised that the police aren't thinking, well, look, unless we arrest a few banksters, there's going to be none of us left.
Well, I think that what we're talking about is the breakdown of society. I was talking to somebody about the other day, and we are pretty well agreed that society is going to break down. It's not a question of if, it's just a question of when.
Crikey. Well, anyway, moving away from Knightstone Island and down south through Western Super Mud, through the murk there, you come to the Tropicana. What's the latest with that?
Well, the Tropicana is that we have to be grateful to developer Derek Mead for all the criticisms that are levelled at him. He did, in actual fact, stop the place being demolished. He's doing his best to do something proper for the public about it.
Isn't he the chap that runs Puxton Park?
He is, but he is genuinely trying to do something good for the town.
He was the former head of the National Farmers Union in Somerset and resigned because he said that National Farmers weren't doing enough for farmers.
Well, I think there will be a lot of people agreed with him. But what Derek has done is Derek actually took Eric Pickles to court under judicial review because the council went up to see Eric Pickles and persuaded him to give consent for the Tropicana to be demolished. Derek Mead got cross and issued proceedings with a lawyer known as Amanda Sutherland, and they managed to get to the point where they got it into court. And at that time I was writing to Eric Pickles telling him about the long-term nature of the fraud, that same people were involved in that as were involved in Knightstone Island. You put a name to them. And I also pointed out that the chairman of the demolition company that demolished the pier after the fire, her opinion, it used to be her father's company, her opinion was that the demolition of Tropicana was worth £100,000. And she had priced the job. The council, with Keir, were applying to the ministry for £1.1 million. Now, I pointed out to the good Eric Pickles, who I have a lot of confidence in, that he was being ripped off for £1 million. And the next thing I know, although you never get a reply on these things, the next thing I know is the good Eric has issued an edict saying Tropicana shall stay.
Well, so are we going to see it opening anytime soon?
I haven't had a meeting with anybody on this one lately. I'm hoping to meet with Derek Mead at some point in the near future because he started a new political party called Western First.
Wow. Interesting, a bit like the Bristol First up here. There was a talk about that and the idea of having independence up in Bristol.
Yes. And I think he's widening this now out to cover the whole of North Somerset. And he is aiming to do good things for the election of 2015. And I think with Mr. Judd's track record, what we know about Mr. Lake's record, and I've got it in writing, Tony, so if you want to sue me, be prepared. And also the record of the past solicitor to the council, Mr. Malcolm Nicholson, now clerk to the town council, who is one of the signatories to the fraudulent lease of 2005. He's actually signed the lease.
Amazing. Anyway, Julian Parry, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined on the line now from Hull by Kirsty McKinder. Hi, Kirsty, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm not too bad. And first of all, tell us a little bit about your background, because I know you worked in the army, and I think it's even intelligence. What was that, and what sort of training did you get?
All sorts of different training, because I started my career off there. I did half the training because it was 6 months trade training, for the intelligence. So I did 3 months of the training. It was really intense, as you can imagine, because obviously...
Well, the thing is, I'm sorry, Kirsty, but I can't imagine. I've got no idea. What do they teach you?
Well, they teach things like counter-terrorism, anti-interrogation techniques, how to drive evasively.
Okay, hang on a minute. Anti-interrogation techniques. How do you stop yourself being interrogated? It sounds a bit awkward to me.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they do like a dummy exercise where they send you out into the town, you were followed, and basically you were to pose as terrorists, like scoping out a shopping centre or an area that you might want to attack, and then we'd get taken in for interrogation based on the scenario that we were doing on that day.
Okay, so but how do you prepare yourself to make sure you're not telling anybody, what you know, because that's what you're being trained to do?
How do you mean?
Well, how do you, someone's trying to get information out of you, how do you stop them?
I mean, they do various things because you can be, I mean, because basically they use colours that they could take you into a white cell or a red cell or a black cell. So they just walk you between the cells. And basically it's just to give you a taste of what it would be like captured.
Okay. Yeah. And evasive driving techniques. Now, I'm sure there's quite a few people listening that think that could be quite good fun.
Quite what, sorry?
Quite good fun.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Once you get on the skid pan, the simulator skid, and you learn how to do 180s and drive fast, but obviously carefully, as safely as you can, at high speeds. They taught us how to shoot lots of different weapons, how to conceal weapons. I mean, basically, they're training you how to kill at the end of the day, and that's the thing that I didn't much like. I know I joined the army at 18, but I soon realised, you know, what they was expecting me to do at the end of the day.
Well, surely, I mean, anybody that's being recruited into the army knows that ultimately you've got to know how to do that. That's what armies do.
Yeah, absolutely. But at 18, I don't think you think too much, you know, of the bigger picture. It's just like a great big adventure. Yeah, I'll join the army, you know. Because obviously they sanitise it a lot with the advertisements. You know, join the army, you can go out with cocktails with girls and have loads of fun. But they never show the real side, you know, of what the army is actually like.
How did you find it as a woman doing that? Because obviously, you know, most of the people who are recruited are men, aren't they? And traditionally would be.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult because if you're not a strong character and you're a woman, then, you know, obviously you're in for quite a bit of a stick, you know, because the army is systemically racist, homophobic, everything you can think of. And obviously, you know, that sort of attitude is not dissuaded, you know.
Okay, so you decided only to do a bit of your training, and you did you do cut it off halfway through or what?
Yeah, did 3 months of it.
But you're not supposed to do that, are you? I mean, I imagine you got into quite a lot of trouble by
saying... Yeah, they spent £100,000 on me up to then. Because basically I was 3 months away from passing out. Because as soon as you pass out from the intelligence corps, you're given a Lance Corporal stripe straight away. And then you're never likely really to wear uniform again. Because what they used the women for was, you know, the honey trapping. You know, pillow talk.
Oh, right. So did they actually train you to do that, to seduce men, to get information from them?
Yeah, they taught you techniques where you could extract information, etc., etc. But, I mean, obviously they're after pretty girls, weren't they? Nice girls, just to send them off to do the dirty work. But I'm glad I left, actually, because I found out subsequently that you can't really ever leave the intelligence corps, so you're either blackmailed, put into retirement... as they like to call it. So it's really quite a dangerous profession. So
it sounds like, you know, the Hotel California, almost like a cult once,
yeah,
once
yeah,
you're
you'll
in.
Yeah, you'll never leave, yeah.
Yeah, so you're glad you didn't go in there. I mean, what other things made you change your mind? Because you were enthusiastic to begin with, but you slowly changed. Tell us about some of the experiences that you had that made you, decide, no, I don't want to do this anymore, sorry.
Well, I mean... there was a lot of psychopaths in uniforms who had high ranks, you know, and positions of power. So basically, what they did was they just waltzed around abusing that power. We was once on a run, and it was a really, like, hard run up a great big hill, and they just kept us going round and round and round, and one of the lads collapsed, and he couldn't carry on. So the sergeant basically instructed everybody to kick him as hard as they could when they went by, so it was just the sheer brutality of it, you know, and that's just scratching the surface. It was just horrendous, you know. They'd get you up for no reason on parade at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, things like that, and get you carrying all the gym equipment around the drill square, perky drill, you know, that sort of thing. It's basically stress positions with your rifle, you know, and I was just thinking, you know, what is going on here?
Now, hang on a minute, because, I mean, surely the idea is to push you to your limit. That's what the basic training is about.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it's more about is breaking your spirit, you know, and especially they like young people to join, because what they're basically doing is taking you and breaking you and then building you back up in their image, you know, so you don't know yourself anymore because it's been drilled into you that much. That's why they call it drill, I think. They drill it into you, you know, and the... there's a lot of messages in the army and comments like, oh, it's above my pay scale, I'm not paid to think. You know, so that was a psychological mantra, you know, that used to run.
Now, if you had carried on, finished your basic training, passed out or whatever, and joined the intelligence corps, what sort of work would you have been doing now?
They'd have probably sent me to Northern Ireland straight away, undercover, with a cover story, and get myself infiltrated with, you know, whoever. But it was all corrupt anyway, you know, completely.
Well, why? What makes you say that? Because obviously there is a need for the British state to know what potential terrorists are doing and what essentially their political opponents are doing in other parts of the country, especially if there's a possibility that they're, you know, the peace process might begin to break down. I mean, we have actually seen terrorist attacks, haven't we, by the real IRA, they call themselves. So there is a need for the British state to be protected against that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. But look into it properly, you can look at the history of Templar barracks in the early 90s. So they were basically sending undercover agents over to Northern Ireland to basically provoke incidents. And it was the intelligence corps that actually killed a lot of people that they shouldn't have. You know, so it's absolutely the wrong way around.
Now, one big scandal that there's been over the last, I suppose, 15 years or so, may even be that far back when it first started, was the Deep Cut Barracks scandal. This is pretty horrific stuff,
yeah.
Where several recruits were found dead, supposedly had committed suicide, but their families said that hadn't happened. I even remember seeing that the police who were trying to investigate found that they themselves were being bugged. So what's your take on that from, you know, maybe some of your inside sources and your knowledge of the way the army operates, Kirsty?
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's quite impossible to commit suicide and be found with two bullets, you know, in your head. Like that's quite absolutely impossible. I mean, the thing at Deep Cut Barracks is that it was an intake for young soldiers, and obviously because you'd got the established officers and the NCOs there, basically saw the new intake as fresh meat, if you like. You know, that's what they saw them as, you know, to be used and abused. And obviously, once you're behind the closed gates of the barracks, you're sitting under the Queen's regulations, which is different, you know. So I'm not surprised the police found themselves bugged because, you know, it's a complete law unto itself. And like I say, once you're in that army camp, you're under a hierarchical structure that's corrupt all the way to the top to the bottom, so there's really nowhere to complain. So you can imagine, you know, how stressed out, you know, these young soldiers were.
Well, people who'd been threatened, for example, had tried to complain, and then there was a senior NCO sent round to them and saying, well, you better withdraw your complaint now, otherwise it will go the worse for you. And these were the people, many of whom, who ended up so-called committing suicide.
Yeah, absolutely, because there was nowhere to go. And that's basically, you know, why them sort of incidents happen, because unless you've experienced, you know, the atmosphere of the army, you can't truly grasp how terrifying it can be.
And would you say there are some regiments that are better and worse than others, some that are actually, you know, a little bit more honest and open, and others that are particularly corrupt?
I mean, I think all of them deal in death and destruction, you know, whether they know they're doing it or not. But I do think that, you know, the soldiers that join the army, I think they're doing it with all good intentions, you know, because if you're not fully aware of the facts, then, you know, some people may see it as an admirable thing to do, you know. But if you, you know, if you're aware that war's big business and, you know, you're just being used as pawns, then it's a whole different matter. But that's not how the army's portrayed, you know. It's portrayed as fun and it's a good thing to do and it's a good career and blah, blah, blah.
Okay, but I mean, also, it is a career for many young people now. In fact, we've got about a million 18 to 24-year-olds out of a job. A lot of them are looking at the army. The army are looking to recruit. They're doing all sorts of deals. I mean, we just heard of another one down here in Western Supermare, where 40 Commando have done some sort of deal with the town council to promote 40 Commando in the town in order to help recruitment. Surely this is going to be bound to be an option for many young people, Kirsty.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a shame because there's so many other things, you know, that the young folk could be doing, you know, rather than being subscribed into a war machine, you know. But if you look at, it's kind of like been orchestrated, you know, with all the austerity, the cuts, and obviously it cuts your choices down as to what you can actually do. If you come from a poor working class background, you know, you're going to think, well, you know, the army is an option. It is terrible, you know, that it's actually turned out that way.
Okay, so anyway, what, you know, you've gone through that experience. What are you up to now? What kind of life have you got? You think it's something better than if you'd stayed in the army?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. 100%, because at least what I'm doing now with the anti-fracking stuff is actually for the benefit of the community.
Anti-fracking. Why have you chosen that as a campaign, something to campaign about?
I think it chose me, Tony. I think it was the other way around. I mean, because as you go through life and you learn different things, you go in different directions. So a lot of what I've learned and been through and experienced, you know, has brought me to this point, because there's only so long you can sit behind a keyboard and write letters and send emails and hold placards. You know, I think there comes a point where you realise that you're not being listened to, and that, you know, the police are actually putting the wishes of the corporation before the will of the people.
So why fracking? Why have you chosen that particularly? What is it that floats your boat about that particular campaign, that issue?
I mean, obviously, I care about humanity as a whole, but, you know, this is an immediate danger. Just for example, where we are in Yorkshire, it's actually on a chalk aquifer, which is porous and already susceptible to pollution. And it's full of nitrates as well, because it's all agricultural land. So obviously, it's really dangerous if you start drilling down 3 kilometres or 10,000 feet and fracturing the bow and shale, because there's a clue. You know, there's a reason why it's 2 miles under the earth. I think it's meant to stay there, you know. So, and there's lots that, you know, you can look at the incidents in America, you know, what's happening now. You know, the practice of hydraulic fracturing is the same the world over. If you look at Gasland, for instance, it shows you the devastation it's caused in America. And obviously, in its infancy in the UK, there's something that we can do about it as a collective, because I'm pretty sure if people were fully aware of the facts and how it'll affect their lives, then, you know, more people would be up here with us.
Now, also with the army and the intelligence community, as they call themselves, the intelligence corps specifically, what would you say to young people who are thinking of joining the army? Because there is actually, surely every country, Kirsty, you must admit, has to have an army of some sort.
That depends. But what I'd say to the young people who are thinking about it, pioneers of a lawless world, are you that refuse it, you know? If there's no young men and young women to fight the wars, there is no wars, you know, that's the stark reality.
But then, you know, people will say, well, what if another Adolf Hitler appears on the scene? It's going to be no good if we don't have an army, is it?
Well, maybe he wouldn't have an army. Maybe if we lived in a more peaceful world where, you know, more attention and energy was drawn to peace and love rather than war and destruction, you know, hopefully we can get a different way of carrying on this planet. But I get what you're saying at the end of the day. But another thing I'd say to people who are considering joining the army, don't. and do what you love. Do what makes you happy, you know. And don't just follow the, you know, blueprint of life. You know, get your GCSEs, go to college, get your A-levels, get your degree. You know, do what makes you happy. And laugh a lot as well.
Okay, Kirsty McKinder from Yorkshire. Thanks very much for joining us.
Just a shout out to everybody to come to the camps. They're at Walkington and West Newton, but you can go on Here Frack Off and find all the details on there. So just come up here, have fun, and just peacefully protest.
Okay, thanks very much, Kirsty.
No problem.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Joining me is Jeff Sparks with the week's What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 13th of June, Hazel Winter will be performing with support from Rita Lynch, Michael McNeil and also Drunken Butterfly at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Also on 13th of June, Thomas McCarthy will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 each and doors open at 7:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Dropkick Murphys. This group formed in 1996 in Quincy, Massachusetts, and to date have released 8 studio albums, 3 live albums, 3 compilation albums, and numerous singles. Now, Woody Guthrie wrote the song Gonna Be a Blackout Tonight, and Dropkick Murphys released it on their album Blackout. Dropkick Murphys with Gonna Be a Blackout Tonight from their album Blackout. For more information on them, you can check out www.dropkickmurphys.com. On to Saturday, 14th of June, Whole Lotta Lead will be performing at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Now, if you're interested, at 10 p.m. after the gig, the venue will be showing the England vs Italy World Cup game on giant screens. Entry is free. Finally, on 15th of June, the Husky Tones will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £4 on the door and doors open at 8:30 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast is on Bristol Community FM at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download this podcast from dialectsradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Elia Pablo, Julian Parry, and former Intelligence Army trainee Kirsty McKinder. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. So, that was Dialect for another week. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
But now Let us say it.